Welcome to the Nature Reliance Podcast, where we explore the history and practical experience of the great outdoors and discover new ways to connect with nature. I'm Craig Cottle, your guide through the fascinating world of natural living and survival skills through experiential education and interviews. Today's episode is brought to you by the Nature Reliance School Online Membership, an immersive online learning experience designed for outdoor enthusiasts just like you. Are you passionate about the outdoors? Do you crave more knowledge about disaster readiness, wilderness survival, bushcraft, tracking, and nature awareness? If so, the Nature Reliance School Online Membership is your gateway to a community of like-minded individuals, all dedicated to learning and sharing essential outdoor skills. With the Nature Reliance School Online Membership, you get exclusive access to a wealth of resources, including expert-led tutorials, interactive webinars, and a library of engaging courses, downloadable books, and documents. Whether you're a beginner or an experienced outdoorsman, there's always something new to learn. So don't wait. Click on the link below to join the Nature Reliance School Online Membership today. Embrace the wilderness, enhance your skills, and become part of a community that values nature as much as you do. Now, let's dive into today's episode. Simon Kenton. What an individual for not only Kentucky history, but American history as a whole. This man's life is remarkable, and it's an unfortunate thing that a lot of people don't know enough about Simon Kenton. In the modern world, Mr. Mel Hancla has been portraying and or reenacting as Simon Kenton for historical significance for decades now. I spoke to Mel recently, and he invited me to his home to talk about Simon, his life, the things that we know about him, the things that we think we know about him. Some of them turned out to be not true. Some of them turned out to be true. I asked a lot of questions during this interview. Mel was incredibly gracious to have me to his home. He showed me a lot of Kenton memorabilia, some artwork, some statues. He's got a larger than life statue of Simon Kenton in his backyard. And I was just so incredibly pleased that he invited me to sit down and chat about Simon Kenton. You're going to love this podcast. Thank you for joining me. As we get started here, here's Mr. Mel Hancla.
Mel Hancla. Am I saying that right?
That's right. You got it.
Tell me about yourself.
We don't have long enough. Right. I grew up on Lake Cumberland. Mm-hmm. And I was... what a wonderful place to grow up. My mother and father were both, my dad was in World War II. My mother was a Rosie the Riveter.
Really?
So worked at Wright-Patterson, Wright Aeronautical, I guess, in Cincinnati while my daddy was in the war. And when they got out, they come back and started an Evinrude boat motor dealership on Lake Cumberland in 1955. It was the year they filled the lake.
Right.
So it was a, you know, it was a wonderful place to grow up. I laugh at my kids talking about jobs, and my first job was cleaning fish, because at the time that I was, you know, 12 and 13 years old, the commercial fishing business was strong in the lake. They hadn't outlawed the gill nets at the time. And spoonbill catfish was king, you know, so people were coming in. I had learned there was a lawyer from Lexington by the name of Charles Landrum, president of the bar for a number of years, really real respected guy, had a cabin down on the lake, and he had learned that the eggs in the spoonbill catfish were freshwater caviar, and it wasn't common knowledge. So what I was doing as I was cleaning fish under the rue of keeping the guts for me to chum for trot lines, I was making more money on the eggs for a couple of years.
Nice.
So that's kind of what I, you know, and my wife loves to fish, you know, and I just, that's one thing it did, you know, doing. And by the time I was 15, I had 15,000 foot of nets, and I was commercial fishing. So I was cleaning fish and catching fish, and it become, you know, really that's how I put myself through college, was commercial fishing on the lake until they introduced the striper bass, and which they tried to tell us wouldn't spawn, and they tried to tell us wouldn't affect the fishery, which it pretty much eliminated all of the the what we call a white bass, and then even the crappie was really destroyed too. And then of course that also destroyed the commercial fishing industry. They the striped bass was getting hung up in the gill nets. And
oh wow, so we put a stop to that.
I'm gonna let this dog out. She's okay. Whining at the door.
That's no problem. So where'd you go to school? That put you through school. Where'd you go to
school? At Western, at Western Kentucky University. And while I was over there, I think kind of to get us to where we're wanting to go today, I could sit and talk about childhood and my teenage years, because it was great. I mean, where I grew up was great, and us having the store was great. But when I went to Western, I ran into a fellow by the name of Archie Stahl, and he was a gunsmith there, and he kind of introduced me to flintlock rifles. And
you had not done anything like
that? I hadn't done anything.
Okay.
We had an old muzzle loader on the place that it belonged to my family, my grandfather. Mm-hmm. And when I was little, you know, 7 or 8 years old, we always shot that gun on Thanksgiving. Always.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
And, you know, there was a persimmon tree, I remember, and they would set me on top of a 5-gallon bucket and lay that rifle on top of a fence post, and we'd shoot at persimmons. And I still remember it. I shot forever before I finally hit one, you know. But that's kind of what got it started. But a guy by the name, are you familiar with Terry Leeper?
I'm not.
Terry started a program in 1984 at Western Kentucky University, and it's now the WKU Gunsmithing Seminar. It's still in existence. Jim Wright of American Pioneer Video is the, I guess, the head of it now. I don't know what the administrator or what the position would be. But in 1984, I was working on my master's degree at Western. Terry had just done a sabbatical at Colonial Williamsburg. So the very first semester.
Building rifles?
He was the head. At that time, he wasn't the head yet. He become the chairman, if you will, of the Industrial Education Department.
Okay.
But at that time, he was just a professor. But yes, he had went to Williamsburg and worked in the gun shop. I don't know how many. I don't know. I really don't understand the sabbaticals that the professors do. I think it was 3 months.
Oh, okay.
I think it's the same thing as a semester.
Yeah.
But when I come back, Archie Stahl had introduced me to Terry. And ultimately, I signed up for a class called Investigations and Industrial Education. So what I did is I built a rifle.
In
college for 3 hours
still
of college credit. I don't know.
At WKU? Man, that would be something.
When Terry was there, you could do it. There were several people done it on top of me. There was a boy from Russell County, Justin Stevens, went through my second semester of the class because, I mean, we cast the brass. We started with a Siler lock, but, you know, we done extensive alterations to the lock. It was wonderful.
You still have that rifle?
I do.
Nice.
Yeah, I do. My oldest daughter claims it.
Yeah.
She says because it took up a lot of the time that I should have been spending with her, I spent on that rifle.
This is one of her siblings, this rifle right
here. And I'll show you after a while the rifle. She's got it, you know. But I've got a pistol, which was the second thing that I built. When I had Don Getz had just bought the Getz Barrel Company from Bob Paris and Son, who started that barrel works. And I bought two barrels. I bought the rifle barrel, 42-inch, 54 caliber, and then I bought a 10-inch, 54 caliber pistol barrel.
Oh, wow.
And when I started with the stock, I literally cut the pistol stock out of the right below where the trigger guard would go on a rifle.
Okay.
I bought this blank of wood, you know,
yeah,
large enough to where I could get a pistol out of it, too. But I have the pistol here, and I can show it to you after a while.
All right, great.
But in the research from there took me to Herschel House. Herschel only lived 30 miles out of town, if that, you know, in Woodbury, Kentucky. So I literally went and introduced myself to him. And the way I found him, they just opened the Western Kentucky Parkway at the time, and I literally I was on my way to the courthouse to see if I could find somebody to give me an address, because all I knew about Herschel was what I'd read in the Foxfire book, Foxfire 5. And but when I stopped at the toll booth, I asked the girl, and she knew exactly where he lived. So she gave me instructions, and, you know, from there, the next semester, there was a fellow by the name of Jay Anderson that was on the national board of the National Humanities Council. And he was teaching. I took a folklore class under my master's study for him. And he was talking about the NEA, the National Endowment of the Arts Apprenticeship Program. Mm. And I was excited when he started telling about it. You know, by the time class was over, I had trouble sitting still. But I went up, and he and I spent the next 2 hours discussing this. And ultimately, within a day or two, by that time, I already knew Herschel, had been there several times. But in a day or two, I went down and talked to Herschel, and he agreed to allow me to write a grant. It was the Folk Art Apprenticeship Program for me to apprentice to him, mm-hmm. and they would pay him for 300 hours.
Fantastic.
So, now, and they don't do that anymore, this was in 1984.
So this is before, well, I mean, Herschel's Herschel, yeah. but it's before everybody knew Herschel.
That's right.
I mean, this is real early on. When did Foxfire 5 come out?
We'll be back after a quick break. Hey, guys and gals, a quick break in our episode to talk about a game changer in outdoor cooking, the Fire Maple Backpacking and Camping Stove System. Whether you're hiking, fishing, or even prepping for emergencies, this portable pot and jet burner is a must-have in your gear. Best part? It's nearly half the price of a comparable JetBoil stove system. Thanks to its leading heat exchange technology, you'll experience reduced boiling times by up to 30% compared to traditional stoves, even in windy conditions. That means more time enjoying the outdoors and less time cooking. Are you ready to upgrade your outdoor cooking game? Click the link in the description now to grab yours. Trust me, your outdoor adventures will never be the same.
You know, I'm not for sure, but it was in the 70s.
Yeah.
And from there, you know, of course, I met Herschel first and ended up working in the shop almost 3 years. I had a workbench at Herschel's for almost 3 years. And before, and the reason that I guess we parted ways, so to speak, is I took a job at Indiana State University. Hmm. So I went to ISU in Terre Haute, Indiana, and literally taught a gun building class there for three semesters.
Now, was that part of your master's, or was that
We're done past the master's. Yeah, okay. It's master's is already over with, and I was able to get the job at ISU because of having a master's degree.
Gotcha. What was your master's in?
Administration, but the area of concentration was wildlife conservation and ecology.
Okay, interesting.
So really what I was teaching, the job that I took at Indiana State University, I was the manager of their field campus in Brazil, Indiana. And we taught hunting and fishing skills and firearms marksmanship. And, you know, one of the first programs I did was poisonous snakes and spiders. Of course, that was a program that I'd done in my master's degree, you know, in Kentucky. So to begin with, it was poisonous snakes and spiders in Kentucky, and that blossomed on into Indiana. But that kind of, that really started me, I guess, on a track of doing educational kind of programs and lectures was that particular program. That was the first slideshow. Of course, at that day, and there was no such thing as a PowerPoint program at that point in time, but it was a slideshow. And
you liked this. I mean, you liked educating folks.
Oh, I loved it. Yeah.
So you still do, obviously.
Well, I'm an educator. You know, my doctorate degree is in education, in higher education. And that's still what I am, you know, regardless of collecting or brokering Americana, still the thing that I do the most is I'm leaving this weekend to go to Nashville. So, yeah, I'll have a for sale table there. But also one of my tables will be an educational display on the Jacob Young rifle, which was made in Tennessee. So even with that, even going to this largest Civil War show in the country, 900 tables, probably one of the things that's most important to me is educating these Tennesseans that will be coming to this show about a long rifle that was made in Tennessee.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Nice. I love it.
So, but yeah, you know, that's me. That's where I got started.
Thank you for sharing that. Well, I came here to talk about Kenton, okay. Simon Kenton. Where do we even start? I thought about this. I've been thinking about this ever since I talked to you. Where do we start? Do we just go down the timeline of Kenton's life, or
well,
what do you like to do? Because I know you talk about Kenton a lot.
Well, all right, let me kind of blend that from how I got to be interested in Kenton.
Okay, good.
The reason that Herschel was included, and actually that whole Foxfire 5 series about muzzle-loading rifles, Elliot Wigington, who was the editor and was the teacher for the Foxfire Fund, which was a group of high school students in Raven Gap, Georgia. These Foxfire books was literally a high school project.
I went to the museum last year.
Okay. Well, Earl Anning lives in Waynesville, North Carolina, and had already had a reputation for building rifles. He had introduced himself to Joe Kendig, had taught a class at Western North Carolina University. So Elliot Wigington came to see Earl, and Earl knew these other people. So it's even like with Herschel. He was the one that introduced Herschel to Elliot Wigington, or vice versa, and was the reason that all of that group, Jim Chambers and Robert Watts and all of them, was included in Foxfire 5. But I lost my father when I was 20, and I met Earl when I was 22. And quickly we developed a friendship, and he has been, you know, my mentor, my best friend, my father figure. I know in the introduction of my book, I wrote that Earl had shook me when I needed shaking and praised me when I needed praising, and done them both with great enthusiasm. But I was in between jobs, you know, in the 80s, work was rough. I was overqualified for most things. You couldn't find a job. Make a long story short, I come home. I took a job at Clinton County High School and was teaching over there. And I come home on a Thursday evening and got the local Russell County News. And there was a thing that was a call for characters for the Kentucky Humanities Council. Hmm. Well, immediately I knew I could portray and tell Kenton's story because of Earl. I think you could probably see behind me this bronze of Simon Kenton that's standing here. Earl had just completed this.
Keep talking. I'm going to make sure we can see
it. Okay. That. Earl had just completed this bronze and had spent probably 16 or 18 years researching Kenton, even to the point that at that point in time, we only know of one painting that was done from life by Morgan. He was 80-some years old. Earl took that to police forensic experts in Atlanta, Georgia, and had Kenton's face rebuilt as a 21-year-old man.
Oh, wow.
And that was the culmination of this. So I knew Earl had all of this research. And Earl introduced me to Alan Eckert, that we were talking to a while ago. So anyway, Friday morning, I called the Humanities Council, said, hey, I've just seen this. The deadline was the next day.
Oh,
the
wow.
deadline was Friday. And I said, is there any way, what can I do? And Virginia Smith, that was the executive director, she said, if you'll hand deliver it and be here Monday morning, we're not going to be able to look at anything on Monday morning. So I worked all weekend, took the day off, left home 5 o'clock in the morning, Jamestown, Kentucky, and drove to Lexington to the Humanities Council and delivered, you know, my application to become one of their Chautauqua players, which every year they added five characters to their team of Chautauqua characters. And so that started me on a path of learning about Simon Kenton. And as I told you earlier, been a major part of my life. Earl introduced me to Alan Eckert. And going back to kind of our conversation and your question earlier, Alan told me personally one time that the worst mistake that he ever made was stating in the front of the Frontiersman. That's probably the best story of Simon Kenton that's told. He said the worst mistake he has ever made was saying everything in this book is true. Mm-hmm. And it's not because it's not true.
Right.
All right, though, because all of the research, Alan's research is impeccable.
Right.
So everything is you know, there's author's notes, there's footnotes. And if, as you read The Frontiersman, if you go to the footnotes, it'll send you to the original documentation and research of that particular story. Where people have got a bad name on Alan, it's not that everything didn't happen. In order to make it a good read, Alan had to put color on it.
Sure.
So if he's talking about Simon Kenton being burned at the stake, all of the color, all of these things that you could only assume because there isn't a document 200 years old that says he done this and that done this and this person done this, he added those things.
Sure.
So it actually is more of a docudrama. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not that the book's not true. It's not that the story's not true. It's just that as it is written, there's a lot of color. There's a lot of things that's been added, not necessarily takes away of the outcome of the story, the way the story started, the way the story ended, but the color that had to be added from an author's perspective in order to tell that story and make it a good read.
Mm-hmm. And he did. It's a great read.
Oh, it's a great read.
I thought he was clear that it was it's a historical narrative. He didn't say it was a document.
Yeah, but he wrote in the front of the book, if you go back, everything. And I don't remember if it was all of the stories or how it was. And it was just a misleading statement. Mm-hmm. But Alan was a great guy. Mm-hmm. And he loved this bronze.
Yeah.
He and Earl had become good friends, you know, while this was going on. And literally, I met Alan at Earl's house. He was visiting. And that was before he'd moved to California. But we stayed friends all the way until he died, you know, in California, probably 10 years ago now.
Now, are there other books that you were fans of, that you're a fan of on Kenton's life? Edna's book or
Edna's
Dr.
book,
Clark's book? Or?
They're both okay. Mm-hmm. But now, to me, the best book is... The best book is this little book that was written in 1909 by Samuel Lodge Cochran. Oh, that's fine.
Sorry.
It's okay.
Very sorry. This is the one to get, huh?
Yeah, and it's hard to get.
Yeah.
It's a hard find. You know, it really is. You might be able to find one.
If I show this front
of
the camera.
Fine. Absolutely.
People will be interested in this. So this one is probably as close to accuracy
to,
as
to me,
anything
this is the best. It's, you know, and it's not dry. Again, I think there's some things in Edna's book that's just not right. Mm. You know, so that takes me, it's not that, this, again, it's not that it's, to me, actually, probably Eckert's book, The Frontiersman, in a lot of ways is more accurate than Edna's book.
Really? Interesting. Okay. Yeah. That's one of the reasons I wanted to come here.
You know,
because I want to know what resources to go with.
Well, there's probably no fewer than 10 different books on Kenton. Ray Crane wrote a couple of books that never really become popular. He was from Urbana, Ohio, you know, up where Kenton is buried at now. Wrote some great things. Dr. Clark's book is good. When I first started going around, you know, I've done as I developed this Chautauqua character, this first person character of Simon Kenton, I literally have presented it 1,000 times.
Wow.
And it got to the point I've just kind of, still people hit me up to do it. I'm too old. It takes too much out of me, you know, to do it the way that I like to do it because it was crazy. You know, as you do those things, the script goes away. I had a guy tell me one time, said, and I tell you, it was Jim Clotter at the Filson. You know, he had heard me do Kenton, and he said, I want to hear this again when the script goes away. Because after you've done it, you know, 30 or 40 or 50 times, all of a sudden you start telling the story instead of trying to follow a script to do this. And
And it did. Dr. Potter that taught at UK.
Yeah.
He was my Kentucky history professor at UK.
Yeah. Yeah, great guy. Mm-hmm. Yeah, great guy. But going back to the to Kenton the man, you know, that whole story, you know, of him, and there's great documentation. You know, there's great documentation of Kenton's story. You know, he got in a fight with a guy by the name of Willie Leachman, you know, mm-hmm. when he was 16 years old. Actually, the first fight happened when he was 15. You know, when he was 16 years and 7 days old when he fought Willie Leachman the second time and thought he'd killed him.
And that's when he left.
You know, he left home.
Did he lift immediately at that?
Immediately. At that just like, left. I mean, he thought, you know, even he was interviewed in later years and he said he was sure that he killed him. He wow. said he wasn't breathing, said there was no sign, said he sat with him for over an hour. You know,
I didn't know that.
trying to roust him about and you know, was convinced. And even as he was running, there was an old man that had come to his house as a young boy. And I know when I was doing the Chautauqua performance, is one of the things that I always do is I would have the crowd to reminisce back to their childhood. And I'll do this to you. When you was 5, 6, or 7 years old, there was an old man. They was some old man that aggravated the living hell out of you.
You're right.
Everybody had one, you know. Right. Everybody had
yes.
one.
You yes,
know?
Sir.
So
yes, sir.
Kenton, you know, he told this that there was this old man that come to his house. And he said that young Kenton said, any a feller got as many molds on their neck as you do. And Kenton had a big pile of molds, you know. Said, surely going to hang someday. So here he's killed Willie Leachman. And in his mind, he's going to hang.
Oh, wow.
So, okay. you know, he hits what the roads. Effect. And even, you know, he said on more than one occasion that he would sit and say, you know, I've got to go back. I've got to own up to this. I've got to go back. And he would get up and start to turn around. And he'd say he'd feel the noose tighten around his neck.
Because of this old man saying this.
Yeah, yeah. That one thing as a child had set that in his mind that he was going to hang. You know, he knew he was, if he went back, he was going to hang. So it just started, you know, he started.
Is this when he took on the alias of Butler?
Yeah, but Butler was the ninth name.
Oh, really?
Yeah. He had run into some fellas 3 days into his journey, and he'd run into some fellas that was clearing new ground. And, you know, it had helped them get a stump out of the ground and then had talked them out of some water. And just in conversation, he'd heard the name of a family about a day's journey. Mm-hmm. So he'd went on. And that very first day, he'd learned what their name was. So he'd also come to realize how lonesome that the pioneers were, mm-hmm. you know, that they really clinged on to family. Mm. And to be accepted, he took their name. And then that time,
he gathered
a name, and every time he would leave, he'd have another name at another place. So when he took the name Butler, he had heard of Jacob Butler, mm-hmm. you know, that had a mill, was needing some help. And so he worked there for a while and basically got worried. It was such a bustle of activity, and he was wanting to go.
Worried that he was going to be discovered,
yes.
who he was.
Yeah. Okay. But also, you know, he had told, you know, there's some journals. And he said when he was sitting, you know, he'd stay hid in the woods all day. And he wouldn't start his journey back to nightfall for those first 3 or 4 days. And said he kept thinking about his Uncle Tom Kenton. Because he'd come to the house when he was young and tell tales. And tell tales about this land down on the lower Ohio River and how fertile it was and that there was buffalo so many that when they rumbled by, they'd shake the earth enough to make mm-hmm. your teeth shake in your mouth. And they was a type of bird that would fly over and darken the skies and those kinds of things. And so that's what he wanted
so
to do.
So was Kenton's uncle, was he like an explorer?
He was an Indian trader that had been in here before. He had already come into the interior of Kentucky. Yeah.
Okay. Interesting.
And that was the tales that was being brought back. Okay. And, you know, that was the fairy tale, the mythical Kentucky that was being told in Virginia at that particular time.
So this crazy old man that said he was going to hang, and this uncle set his destiny.
That's right.
In many ways.
That's right. And that's why he ended up here. And then, of course, you know, the whole story with Butler and the mill, you know, the Indians always called him Butler, because that's he'd introduced himself as Simon Butler. Worked there a while.
And where was the mill? Where was Jacob's mill at?
It was in Cold Springs, Virginia. And if you cut across I-64, you see the Cold Springs exit about 15 or 20 miles back from Lexington, Virginia.
Okay.
And the mill's still there. It's been redone. You can literally go there and visit that location.
Interesting.
But he decided he was going to go to Fort Pitt. He wasn't finding anybody heading on west. So he is going to go to Fort Pitt and head down the river. He'd figured out by that time the Indians was too rough to try to, you know, to find his way and go through the Cumberland Gap. He was still, you know, hundreds of miles from getting. And he, again, didn't want to ask for much help. And he was 16 years old.
Wow. So he was making a living, literally, working as a millwright working in the mill.
And the old man gave him a rifle. You know, him and the old man they made friends, and the old man gave him a rifle. That's described. He described, that it had a daisy on the brass box, and what he describes is a Lancaster County rifle. You know, probably from 1780.
In brass.
Something. Yep.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. It was a Flinter?
Oh, it had to have been. Yeah. There wouldn't have been anything else at that point in time.
How big was it?
I don't know.
Didn't say that.
Not that detailed.
Okay. Gotcha. So where did he go from there? Did he go to Pitt?
No. He didn't travel far, and he run into a fella by the name of Thomas Williams. And they then run into a fella whose name was Strader, and they called him the Long Dutchman. He was an older fella. And Thomas Williams and Kenton were about the same age. And he said when they run into the old Dutchman that he was telling tales, familiar tales of the, you know,
of Kentucky,
and that the Dutchman had been kidnapped as a baby by the Indians and had lived amongst them for a number of years.
By Shawnee?
I'm sure it would have been Shawnee.
Okay.
I feel that it would have been, but I can't swear to that.
Okay.
But now he ended up, the story is told that it was raining, cold, probably like this, you know, and they'd been like running traps, come in at dark, took their clothes off and had them hanging by the fire so they'd dry. And the Indian, you know, and they didn't worry about Indian attack because that wasn't something they usually done after dark. But they killed the Dutchman. The Indians come in, you know, kind of come in, attacked them, killed the Dutchman. And all they had time to do was yell at one another, meet at the bear trap. So here's these two guys naked.
Now, 16 years old.
16 years old, freezing rain, wet, and no clothes, naked.
I tell this story all the time. I want to make sure I understand I've got it right.
Yeah.
So well, how long were they out?
The best I can figure, and again, it's been a long time since I've researched this, but 4 or 5 days.
That's incredible to me.
And they were about dead when they'd stumbled down, I think, to the Kanawha River. I think it was the Kanawha. And
so where are they at when this is happening, when they got attacked?
Well, it would have been somewhere north of it would have been north of Warm Springs, but it would have been kind of on the way to Pittsburgh. So if you ever come across 79 from Morgantown, West Virginia, there's a bridge that crosses the Kanawha River. Actually, it's dammed up now, and I don't know if it's a lake or what it is, but I think that's where they were at. But they run up on the Great House Party.
Jacob? Or
the whole party. I don't know which ones was there, but it was the same gangs that was given the credit, you know, for starting the Battle of Point Pleasant. that supposedly killed Logan's family. And I know there's some documentation now that's kind of alluding that they didn't do it, that they had accused of something that they really didn't do. But I think it would have been Jacob Greathouse. But the boys were about dead, and they
had to be hypothermic.
Well, they got them drunk. And Kenton
the
got
the Greathouse party got the boys drunk.
But I think it was the way that I read it. The way that I, let's say that I took it on, is that they were trying to save them. They were trying to nurse them back to health, and they was using alcohol. They wasn't giving it to them to get them drunk. They was giving it to them as a medicine to try to nurse them back to health. And but the reason I even bring that up is that from that time forward, Kenton would not drink.
Oh, wow.
He stopped
that
drinking.
That experience did it.
That experience completely took him away from alcohol.
Interesting.
Yeah. There are several times in his later life, you know, that there was even in the Draper papers of where he was interviewed, and, you know, that alcohol never again touched his lips.
Hmm. You know, I didn't know it was that event that did that to him.
Yeah.
Was it because he felt out of control or just vulnerable?
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know. I don't know.
It
was just enough to change his life that he never done that again. But, you know, he made the comment in these interviews. They spent about 4 years on the Kanawha River at that point in time. After they healed up, he didn't come on into Kentucky at that time. And he
did
said
he stay with the Greathouse party?
I don't know. Okay. I don't think so. You know, you asked that question, and I have to truthfully say I don't know.
Sure, that's fine.
But I don't think so, because I know he had said that if there was ever a time that was paradise, it was those 4 years on the Kanawha before he come on into Kentucky.
Just because he loved that area?
I think he wasn't bothered. The Indians wasn't bothering him. He was in a situation that he wasn't afraid. Mm-hmm. You know, I think he was living off the land. I think he was trapping and hunting, and life was good.
I dig that.
Life was good and stress-free, probably for the only time, you know, since he'd been a child, and maybe for the only time for the rest of his life.
But he was still a butler, Simon Butler at this time. Has he ever taken on his true identity?
Well, let me think just a minute. I don't know. I don't know what the years are, but he discovered that he hadn't killed Willie Leachman. And the way that he discovered that is that he had met a party. He was into Kentucky, and he was down close to Louisville. He was up the river from Louisville, up from the Falls of the Ohio, and they call it Three Mile Island now, but he describes it, and that he realized that there was this group of settlers that was coming in. You know, by this time, Kenton was already at Maysville. He already had a station up at Old Washington, but he loved to lead people. You know, he liked to be called the welcomer in chief to Kentucky, because that was at a place that everybody, when they come in Limestone Creek, the way it branches off up there off of the Ohio, made for a good dropping off place. And if they were coming into the middle bluegrass or the middle of Kentucky, that's where they'd come through. But anyway, he told the story that he was up by the three islands, the Three Mile Island, and he realized he'd seen a group come in. He'd seen their smoke for over a mile, and you know that he got within so close that when he stepped out behind a tree and said hello there, it all scared him to death, you know. But it was obvious that they were new, you know, and he tried to be kind and you know, trying to tell them the dangers that they was in for. You know, they kind of told him where they wanted to go, but one of these people looked really familiar. So he just kind of kept watching him and finally caught him beside himself and struck up a conversation. You know, he said, the boy told him he was from Fauquier County, Virginia,
off of
Bull Run Mountain, you know, Kenton said it was only with the greatest of inward calm that he continued to quiz him. He said, well, he was through that very part of the countryside one time, and the whole ridge was in an uproar about a young fella killing another one. And he butchered their names, you know, some fella maybe. And the guy said, no, you got it all wrong. Said the name was Leachman, Willie Leachman, and it was he who killed Simon Kenton.
Oh, my gosh.
So
can you imagine the relief?
No. And
the relief that he felt?
Well, but on the other hand, you know, and it went on, you know, the boy told him, he said, they tried Willie Leachman for murder.
Oh, wow.
But they had to let him go for lack of evidence. They couldn't find Kenton's body, you know. And he said, this Kenton, you knew him? He said, knew him? Hell, he was my brother. So he run into his brother, and, you know, that was 15 years younger than him. So when he left him.
The kid that's telling the story is his actual brother?
That is actually Kenton's brother. That's how he learned that he had not killed Willie Leachman.
So did he tell him at this
point? Oh, yeah. This, you know, that's what he, you know, that's what the kid had said. You know, it was that Kenton had the story backwards. It was Willie Leachman that had killed Simon because they thought he was dead.
Right. Yeah.
They thought he'd hid the body.
I did not know it was brother that told him the story. Oh, my gosh.
So, you know, and at that point in time, he said he started planning for a trip back, and he literally ended up moving his whole family in. They built a 40-foot flatboat and brought everything into what's now Old Washington, to the up at the landing at Limestone, and he moved the whole family.
Right. And he stayed he was a fairly dedicated family man, wasn't he? It's going to be interesting.
Well, yes and no. Mm-hmm. He was a pretty dedicated family man. He had two wives. You know, his first wife burned in a house fire, and she was pregnant, having their fifth child. And the house caught fire. She was burned. The baby was born still. And then he ended up in, what was her name? I can't remember her name right now. But anyway, he ended up marrying her first cousin that was only like 14 or 15 years old. Mm. And that created a rue. But somewhere in there, and I don't know the time frame, I don't really, but he was captured and taken to Detroit by the British. And he made friends with the British commander's wife. And had a child named Simon Ruth.
It was a female?
Girl. A girl.
Simon Ruth.
Her name was Simon Ruth. Wow. Yeah. And it was her. It was the woman that had either released Simon Kenton or created the scenario for him to be able to escape and make it
back
home.
So this is a piece I had no idea
about. But now he ended up, that child, Simon Ruth, ended up coming to Kentucky. He was living on Quirk's Run over close to Danville. Mm-hmm. At the time when the girl come to live with him.
Hmm. But he never had a relationship with her other than that?
I don't think so.
With the child's mother?
I don't think so.
Other than that?
Yeah. Now, there's another, and I think this is in Ohio, but now there is an existent warrant for his arrest for fornication.
For that relationship?
I don't think so.
Something different.
I think it was for something different.
Oh, man.
So you asked me if he was a good family man. I think he probably was. But he probably had a wandering eye as well.
Mm, interesting. See, that's a piece of the puzzle I didn't know at all. Good information. So he's living near what we call Danville.
Yeah. It's spelled Quirks, but I think they pronounce it over there Quick's Run.
Okay.
And I don't remember exactly where it's at, but Clem Caldwell, do you know that name?
Mm-mm.
Clemens Caldwell was quite the character. He was one of the premier collectors of Kentucky things for a number of years. If you're over by Danville, where 127 comes through Danville and heads like you're going to Harrodsburg, where the new road, Maple Avenue, comes out around the new bypass, there's a big house, a big federal period house with, I don't know, 6 or 8 or 10 chimneys on this thing. Hmm. And that was Caldwell Station. It's on Filson's map, his 1784 map of Kentucky.
Okay.
So, you know, the house had been built up around the original log houses and stone houses. But old farm. He's, Clem's been dead for years now, and the farm's been divvied up and sold. But it was, anyway, I don't even know what I brought Clem up for now.
I'd like to dig into Simon's role as a scout. What can you share about that?
I really don't know. I know that somewhere he made the comment that he pretty much missed out on the revolution going back east. Said he did do a couple of spying jobs for General George Rogers Clark, but that he couldn't talk about those.
Oh, really?
Interesting. So as far as I know, from what research I've done, I don't know of any documentation, anything that come from him about him being a scout other than that.
Interesting. So most of his woodsmanship skills were developed as a trapper and a hunter.
I think so, and trying to live, trying to escape a past and to live. And but I don't know, I mean, it's crazy stuff. Just like, I've studied the War of 1812 and specifically the Battle of the Thames a lot, and Simon was there.
Mm-hmm.
It was, how was it? The story goes that he met his son. He was on a horse and had a bag of grain thrown across the saddle, and that he took the bag of grain and gave it to his son. And how was it? Maybe that's not right. Anyway, his wife had forbid him to go back to war. And when he met his son, he said, "Tell your mother I went to the mill." And he said later on, "I did go to the mill. It just wasn't the mill that she thought I was going to." The mill he went to was up by Newport, Kentucky, where they were all mustering, with William Henry Harrison and Richard Minter Johnson to go to the Battle of the Thames. But hell, he was 60, almost 70 years old. Isaac Shelby was 64 years old, got killed, and Shelby was the one, I think, that had pulled him on board, to go fight that battle.
So how did he get so hung up getting captured by the Shawnee and running the gauntlets? And what was he just out being Simon Kenton, living off the land?
I know the story. They had captured him, and I don't remember now the scenario of how he got captured, but seems like it was either the third or the fourth gauntlet that he was running. Mm-hmm. Of course, they was taking him to Old Town, which is up by Chillicothe.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately that was the last one that he had run. But maybe the third or the fourth, I don't remember the number that it was.
Mm-hmm.
But he had found a weak spot when he was running this gauntlet. And I almost hesitate to say it, but I will. I think it was a heavy lady, an elderly lady that had a lot of finish. And he knocked her down and was running away.
He gone.
And Blue Jacket had heard that they had captured someone. He wasn't for sure who it was. But he was riding in and sees this naked man running away, and Blue Jacket runs him down, and to keep from killing him, turns his tomahawk sideways and hits him with the flat of the tomahawk, which...
It wasn't actually the pipe head?
No. If it had been the pipe head, it'd have killed him, see? But he hit him with the flat of the tomahawk, which always still caused a concussion, and he always had a mark on his head from it. Anyway, that's the way that I've read it.
Okay.
Because I feel like if it had been the pipe or the blade, either one would have killed him.
Right.
And he didn't want to kill him. The deal, he wanted...
So did he know it was Kenton?
He recognized it as Kenton.
Okay. So is that because he respected him, or do we know?
No, good question. Don't know. Got to let my dog back.
Yeah, sure. No problem.
She'll pits a fit until I do. Come on.
Just gave me a good opportunity to check the camera. Everything's good.
How's our time?
We're at 46 minutes. We're doing great. We're doing great.
Okay.
Doing great.
Well,
I appreciate your time, man.
Oh, you're welcome. You're welcome. It's an honor to do this. Like I said, you know, Kenton's been such a big part of my life. And we'll have to be careful because I can talk, you know, this is just, again, it just goes on and on and on, you know.
So but we anyway, don't know if Blue Jacket knew who he was at this time?
I'm pretty sure he did because he didn't want to kill this person.
Okay.
And I, you know, see, and this is another thing. Okay, so I can sit here and I, you know, okay, so I started doing this research 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm even sitting here, my mind setting is, okay, how much is this really coming out of research? How much of it that I'm regurgitating to you is a story that Alan Eckert even got into trouble for, you know, because I'd done these, like I say, I'd done over 1,000 programs. And I know Merrill P. Deer was the president of the National Muzzle Loading Rifle Association for years. And he had seen me do a program for the CLA, when we first started the CLA now 28 years ago, mm-hmm. I'd done a Simon Kenton program. And after it was over, he said, "Ma'am, it looked wonderful. Can you get me a script?" I didn't hear a word because he was deaf. His hearing was gone.
Oh, wow.
So, I mean, I was only 3 years into it at the time. So I dug him out and printed him off a script. And when I read the script, it was nothing like what I was already had evolved into.
Oh, wow.
Because when you write that script that way, to begin with, you're trying to get it all on paper and get this story on paper. And you know, if you drop a line in a memorization things, oftentimes it screws you up. Mm-hmm. So all of a sudden you've got to shoot from the hip. And within 3 years or four, you know, after I started doing this, it become the story. And you can tell this story a lot of different ways,
mm-hmm,
you know, and you don't even have to tell it in chronological order. You know, if you're halfway through a program and you think, "Man, I didn't do that." And you know, all you got to do is say, "Hey, let me back up a minute," you know, and people don't know that you're, you know, you're not getting out of character. You're staying into character and telling this story. Keep in mind, and I would not only you, but your audience, keep in mind that these stories are getting close to 300 years old.
Sure.
250 or 60 years. We've talked about the books. We've talked about Eden, who was the niece of Simon Kenton. Okay. How accurate was she? How good was her research? I've not dug through it. I've not went and dug out all of her research. Alan Eckert's I did, because I knew Alan and I knew I wanted to document. When I started with the Kentucky Humanities Council, we had to prove our documents. Mm-hmm. You know, I had to, you know, as I went through right. that process, you know, I had to come in and this is this and this is this, you know, and that's why I like Cochrane. The documentation is fantastic. So if you hear me say, "Well, I don't know," it's because I don't want to mislead anybody.
Sure. And I appreciate
you know,
that.
The stories are so old. I can sit here and I've caught myself while we're talking, even regurgitating my program, my mm-hmm. Simon Kenton, you know, the way that I would present him in first person. There was credibility to those stories and that research when I started doing that program 20 years ago. And I feel like that if I was questioned, I could sit down and go to the books and dig it out and say, "This is where I got that." But even still, what I tried to deal with, you know, there was the Draper papers is invaluable. And it took me for years to finally find a printed version of the Draper papers. And they're extremely hard to go through and to deal with. But going to that, you know, Kenton was an old man and he was celebrated and he would have these visitors. These people would come and he'd want to tell their stories. So there's a lot of documentation where other people would go and listen to Kenton. Well, yeah, it's first person. Kenton's telling them this. How correct is it?
Right.
How many of them colored it up?
Yeah.
How many of them, when they wrote it down, you know, it's kind of like Daniel Boone. Hell, we wouldn't know about Daniel Boone if it wasn't for John Filson. Mm-hmm. He was a newspaper writer and wrote the book Kentucky in 1784. And half the shit that we hear about Daniel Boone that's wrong is because of John Filson.
Right.
You know, he
made him out to be a character that just wasn't a real person.
Just wasn't, you know. And I have to be careful, you know. I don't disrespect Boone, and I don't want to say anything disrespectful. But back when there were blackboards in schools,
mm-hmm.
and I was doing schools and doing programs, almost always, if I was, and I was, and I don't remember the year, but they had a Senate Bill 1 that what it did is it mandated this whole group of criteria for social studies in the sixth grade. So I was doing sixth grade. So, and my program fulfilled 3 of the 5 or 6 mandates for social studies. So I was doing a lot of schools. A lot of times I was doing 3 programs a day, have done as many as 5. Gosh. But I'd go to the board. Everybody heard of Boone. Mm-hmm. A lot of people hadn't heard of Kenton. And then I'd start listing things. Well, Daniel Boone done this. Simon Kenton done this. So we'd list them on the board, and I'd literally build the case that Simon Kenton had done more for the Western movement in America and the settlement not only of Kentucky, but the settlement of the United States, that he had done much more than Boone had done.
Well, that's why I'm here, because I believe that wholeheartedly.
Well, he wasn't an arrogant man, you know, from the very beginning. He thought he had killed somebody. He was, you know, and I know in later years, he would talk about that, and he'd say, you know, they thought that I was dead. You know what? You know, he couldn't forgive himself for that whole incident, for him not owning up to it. He couldn't forgive himself for causing the grief to, you know, Willie Leachman's family, because everybody in the community thought he'd killed him.
He was a murderer.
Yeah.
And he wasn't.
So he'd lived all of these years and you know.
Did he ever speak to him again?
Oh, that, yeah. Yeah, they did. And he tried to rectify it. He tried to, you know, he went back and tried to, you know, to smooth all of that out and take credit, you know. But, you know, it's like today. People believe what they want to believe.
Mm-hmm.
So and then they held it hard on Kenton that he'd run, you know. So,
oh, wow.
So, I mean, he was in a conundrum, you know. He was damned if he did and damned if he didn't.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, he was an honorable man.
Mm-hmm. So and Leachman, I think, didn't forgive him for that. Leachman was upset with him over it.
Oh yeah,
because he went to trial for murder for it.
Yeah,
interesting. I didn't realize that either.
Well, and then he went ahead, you know, and married the girl.
Leachman did. The one they were fighting. The girl, they were fighting over a girl, weren't they?
They were fighting over a girl, but then she died giving childbirth for their first child. So he had lived his life alone, and everybody there thought he was a murderer.
Oh, wow. No wonder he was bitter.
You know, well, and, you know.
If I think about his perspective, I get why he's bitter.
Oh, absolutely. Well, Kenton said, how do you forgive yourself for that?
Yeah.
You know, for you to have done something and created, how do you forgive yourself for that?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was his own words. I started to tell you a while ago, you know, they was, he had a place up in Urbana, and when he was running, we're talking about running the gauntlets. Every time he'd run a gauntlet, they'd about kill him. So there was a Shawnee by the name of Bona that they had basically given the responsibility to nurse him back to health. Well, Bona wasn't doing anything. It was the women that was doing all of the nursing, you know, to get him back to health. And but later on, you know, Kenton had stayed friends with the Indians, unlike Boone. You know, Boone had been adopted, and they really, you know, held it against him. I know I went to a thing at Fort Lawrence, Ohio once, and they called it a Pioneer Family Reunion. The Kentons were there. The Shawnee were there. Two different tribes of the Shawnee, the Eastern Remnant Band and the Pequot of the Shawnee was both there. I believe the Wetzels maybe were there. And the Boone family was there. And they would not, the Indians would not be in the same tent with any members of the Boone family.
Really?
I mean, it's
because he walked away from being adopted?
Yep, because he walked away from it, and they felt like that, you know, that he had
wow, even that long, yeah, it lasted.
That family still holds it against him.
But the Kenton family, he did not. I mean,
they love, you know, they had even talk about Kenton, you know, he who was our greatest enemy that become our greatest friend.
What was their name for him? Cut a hope.
I don't know, but they called him Bona forever. And that's what I was.
They called Kenton Bona?
Yeah.
Really? Okay.
No, excuse me. Bodler. They called Kenton Bodler. They couldn't say Butler. And Bona was the Indian's name. Mm. So that's what I was going to tell you about.
Okay.
So
sorry.
Bona, that's fine. Bona was living on Kenton's farm. So he was entertaining guests. There's a great document about it. He was entertaining guests, and it, as it's written, that Bona stumbled through the door and farted as he walked through the door, and he was obviously drunk, and it pissed Kenton off. So he said he jumped to his feet and said, "Bona, why do I put up with you?" And it went on to say, as he arrogantly picked his teeth, he said, "Because I let you live, Bodler. Because I let you live." So, you know, he was arrogant about it. And, you know, but still, Kenton cared enough about him that as an elderly man, he was taking care of him. He let him live on the farm.
Those relationships were deep. They were militaristic at times, and then they just developed strong bonds, didn't they?
Well, and Kenton said often that he felt more attuned with the Indians than he did the white man. You know, he didn't.
Did they ever try to adopt him?
I don't know.
They always tried. It seemed like they always tried to kill him.
I don't remember. I can't say that I ever remember, you know, that coming about.
Did he have any connection or run-ins with Tecumseh? Because so many people, that's why I ask, because so many people know that name.
They would have known one another. And it was Tecumseh's sister, I think. He was somewhere tied at the stake. And the women were, as he was tied out, the women were coming and squatting on him and defecating and peeing on him. Again, I'm digging deep here, and but I think it was Tecumseh that come in and raised hell with the women and made them stop.
Really?
Yeah. That he had enough respect for him that he wasn't going to let that happen. And I think Tecumseh at one time kept him from being burned. They were waiting for somebody, and then I believe the second time they had him at the stake and the fires lit and the rain come and put the fires out. And Tecumseh had taken it as a sign, you know, and
did
I think Tecumseh, they ended up trading him to the British and then he was taken, you know, to Detroit. And that's then the scenario of him making friends with the commandant's wife and getting her pregnant. And then that's how he escaped from the British and got back home. But that all come from an incident with Tecumseh, I'm pretty sure, where he had, you know, they were going to burn him at the stake. The fires got put out by rain. They decided they didn't want that bad juju.
Right.
They didn't want to burn this man. Let's trade him off. He's too valuable. We'll trade him to the British.
So did he run? How many times did he run the gauntlet? Do we know?
Again, I'm drawing a figure out of my hat, but I believe it was 7. And the last gauntlet was more than a mile.
That's incredible.
Going into Old Town. And you can still drive up like you're going to Chillicothe, Ohio. You can see that, you know, it's a big rock up there, you know, with all of that on it, you know, historic Old Town. And, you know, a lot of times we say it's Chillicothe, but it's actually outside. It seemed like it's 5 or 6 miles outside of Chillicothe.
And on the gauntlet, they would whip him with sticks and clubs or
do everything they could to knock him down. You know, I mean, with the men would have had war clubs. The women would have had switches and briars.
He just made it.
And he just He just made it. Yeah.
Gosh, that's incredible. Yeah. No wonder they had so much respect for him.
Yeah, yeah.
Just from the gauntlets, let alone warring that they did.
Well, they had heal him back up. But he was a fair man. I think that's even with the Indians. He didn't kill Indians to be killing Indians. You know, he had in a warfare, if he was being attacked, but I think he was more, instead of course, the Great House boys got a terrible reputation, you know, of being Indian hunters. I've actually got a powder horn over there that belonged to Joseph Fawcett, who married the Great House boy's sister. And on that horn, it says, "Fire on Indians, shoot the rascal." And it's got, you know, got a frontiersman, you know, shooting at Indians. It's crazy stuff.
Wow.
But there's, you know, I mean, there was a group that literally hated the Indians and hunted them like game.
But Kenton wasn't one of those.
He wasn't one of those.
He was not one of those at all.
No.
Interesting.
No, he was more, he had befriended the enemy, or, you know, befriended the enemies and had a respect for them.
So did he have any comments that we know of where it was explained why they would basically almost kill him in a gauntlet and then bring him back to health? Well, I mean,
oh, the for the that? Next gauntlet. So that every one of the Indian villages got the opportunity see him run this gauntlet. He was such a, celebrity, they had Kenton, and they wanted every Indian village. They wanted every one of the Shawnee at each one of these villages to have the opportunity to whip the shit out of him.
Gosh, that's wild.
because that's what they were doing, is they'd get him back to health, only healthy enough for him to take him to the next town and then do it again. And I believe it was now, I said seven, I believe it's nine times. And the reason that we do that is there was nine Indian villages from where he was captured to Old Town. And I think Old Town was the ninth of the gauntlets. And that's another thing, for your audience here, we need to talk about what a gauntlet is.
Yeah, please.
Because it's literally what they were doing is lining up everybody in the Indian village from the youngest to the oldest. Two lines, side by side, making a channel, and that ended at the chief's lodge. And the goal was, is once they started the gauntlet, however, I've heard it read that they would wail at the top of their lungs and beat the drums. And when that shut up, when the drum stopped, you were to start running. And it didn't stop. The beating, the torture did not stop until you laid your hand in the chief's lodge. And that they were doing everything in their power to knock you to the ground. But if they knocked you to the ground, they give you the opportunity and urged you, encouraged you to get back up and to go on. Because they wanted everybody to have a chance, whether it was a switch or a whip or a briar or whatever, regardless of what age or, and we've got to remember, this was a matriarchal society. So it was probably the women that was doing as much damage in this gauntlet as the men were. The men were the warriors, but now it was the women that it was, was the truly the leaders, of
this
these tribes.
This is time to shine.
Yeah.
I mean, from a, I guess from a warrior perspective.
Yeah.
Interesting. I'm assuming that one of the reasons they respected him is because he did make it.
Oh, I
a lot
I
of young people
so.
Didn't, did they?
Oh,
I mean,
yeah.
They just didn't make it through.
Well, and he was such a big man compared to them, And we think of 6 foot not being tall, but he was about 6 foot tall. And but compared to a 5'6", 5'7", 5'8", a big Indian was 5'8", a big person at the time was, 5'8", or 5'9", a white person, a European. So, but he was a big man. He was first buried in, I don't remember. Anyway, his first burial place was not Urbana. And he was reinterred, I believe, in the 1920s.
Oh, wow.
Again, I may be wrong. Those dates may be wrong. However, I'd always heard that he was a redhead. And sure enough, when they reinterred him, there is the museum there has his hair. And it, I don't guess all of it, but they, and it's obvious his hair is red.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. Interesting.
Kind of like mine. I think there's a lot of gray in it, but, and they were able to, I know they'd done some investigation as far as height and those kinds of things when he was reburied and taken to Urbana to be buried there. And of course, there's a big monument, for Simon Kenton's grave. But if you guarantee you go there today and out around that monument, there's a path about that deep, about that wide. And at every one of the solstices, the Indians come there and honor Kenton. And they leave sweet grass and copper on his grave.
Now? Wow.
And their whole thing is he who was our greatest enemy and become our greatest friend. I mean, they still
revert. Where is this grave at now?
In Urbana, Ohio.
It's in Urbana now. So he was 6 foot tall, which is a big man on the frontier. Tell me about what we know of his horn, his knife, his rifle. Do we know anything?
There's at least two guns that's has been attributed to him. One's in the Huntington Museum of Art. if he owned it, he was an old man. They're not Frontiers rifles at all. There's a smooth bore that's in the little museum, and I'll think of it in a minute. But there's a smooth bore that's attributed to have been his. It was made too late. It's the kind of thing that it, first of all, it's not the kind of gun that he would have wanted. And going back to powder horns and stuff, you know, I done the book a few years ago in 2020 is when it was launched.
I brought it and I need to get you to sign it.
Oh, I'll be glad. I'd be glad to. I didn't put anything in that book that I couldn't document, that I could not find a primary documentation to either prove to me who owned it or who made it. And if you'll notice, there's nothing in there that I attributed to be owned by Simon Kenton, except this painting. And this is kind of wild. This painting sold at auction up by Cleveland, Ohio. There was a fella here in Kentucky bought it, a fella from Richmond. It had been sold as a Matthew Harris Jewett painting. We've got an art expert here in the state of Kentucky that he took it to and give the boy $500 to verify if it was a Simon Kenton painting. I mean, a Matthew Harris Jewett painting, who is Kentucky's premier artist, you know. So he told him no, that it wasn't. But that's all he told him. So probably the same day, I got a call from this guy, and he said, "Hey, I know you're interested in Simon Kenton." Said, "Would you like to have a Simon Kenton painting?" I said, "Of course I would." He said, "Well, for $500, I'll tell you where it's at."
Oh, wow. Oh, my gosh.
So I paid him $500, and he told me where the painting was, and it took me two more years to trade for it, but I finally was able to get it.
Nice.
But then when I took it to the Simon Kenton Festival, where the Simon Kenton kinfolk have their reunion every year at Old Washington, at his old station.
I went there 2 years ago.
Well, I had this on exhibit, and there was a little old lady come in and burst out in tears, and she remembered the painting as a little girl and told me the entire, where it had been, who had had it. And then when I went back to the auction company, they verified that indeed is.
And that girl was the older lady was a Kenton?
She was a Kenton. Oh, she was a descendant of his son, Mark. So I was able to verify. You know, of course, there wasn't any doubt, you know, once you looked at it and compared it with the other images. You know, I guess there's three other paintings of Kenton that we know of. But anyway, it's just he's been a big part of my world.
Mm-hmm. What information out there do we need to share with them that has been, this needs to be known by people? A lot of people have a misunderstanding of it. Is there anything that I've missed that you'd like to share?
I will say this. There's, you know, you asked just in your question before that. I'm going to kind of use that to blend into your question right now. There's only one item that I know of that I feel comfortable of saying that it belonged to Simon Kenton. It's in the family.
Mm-hmm.
A fifth great grandson had this knife, which had been a broken British short sword.
Mm-hmm.
And the grips had been broken off. It had been sharpened into a dagger. But it's the kind of thing that it had been turned into a fighting knife.
Mm-hmm.
And it would have easily dated to the 1770s. And it had never left the family. You know, there was documentations. I could tell you all the way back of who had passed it all the way back. And since then, the fellow that had it has passed it to his youngest son. And he's now dead. I'm not going to tell you what his name was.
Mm-hmm. Sure. I understand.
But
seen it?
Oh, I have seen it. Yeah, mm-hmm. I've seen it and handled it. And if I could have got my hands on it, I would have put that in my book.
Mm-hmm.
The whole deal with Kenton, he was such an honorable man.
Mm-hmm.
It's as if, you know, two or three things had happened in his life. That, you know, it's like we talked early on, you know, he thought he killed Willie Leachman and then he ran away. But even as an old man, he said, well, he really wanted to go back. But because of these statements, because of him, his fear of death, And we don't have any idea the way of life at that point in time. You know, they may have very easily went off half cocked and hung him, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He felt that way anyway. So you've got that. And I believe because of that, because that he learned that he hadn't killed Leachman, because of the alcohol and the Great House Boys and that experience, which obviously was not a good one for it to cause, it changed who Simon Kenton was. He didn't have a John Filson to tell his story.
Mm-hmm.
In a lot of ways, I told somebody one time that I wanted to be Kenton's John Filson, mm-hmm. that I wanted to write about him. I wanted to tell his story. And I will say that with me doing that program 1,000 times, I'd say that I averaged 50 people at a meeting. So how many mm-hmm. people is that I've told the story to?
Right.
And it's even like with you, you know, when you said, well, you'd love to do this interview and us talk about him. I felt honored that you would want to do that because I feel like his story needs to be told. I feel like that because of all of the, and specifically Boone, you know, we're overshadowed with Boone and what Boone mm-hmm. did. And I just feel like Kenton done so much more. But on the other hand, let's put it this way. I think he was equally as important to Kentucky and to the Western migration of America and the settlement, not only of Kentucky, but to America. I just think we need to keep him in mind.
Is there ever a thought of you writing a book on Kenton?
No, I tell you there is no way in the world, unless you've written a book, there's no way in the world that I can tell you how much that it takes. And the book that you have, I started a book 30 years ago on the evolution of the American long rifle. And I was probably, 200 pages or something into a document. I really hadn't started pulling it together with a book or putting it with photographs. I went through a terrible divorce 14 years ago, went to Canada. And when I come back home, my house was empty. And the judge ordered my ex-wife to bring all my office back. But when my office came back, I had a 250 gigabyte external hard drive that I had my book on, and it had been formatted.
Oh, my gosh.
So the book was gone. And 2019, they asked me to curate, pull together an exhibit on rifles made in Kentucky at the Kentucky Historical Society. So I wanted a catalog. We were going to open this exhibit the first day of May. So I started, I wanted to get this catalog done. We pulled the guns together, got the photographs done, and I sat down and started writing this catalog. And the next thing I knew, I was about 80 pages. Things were coming back, see, that from that other book, things that were still in my mind. And I remember I went upstairs and talked to Angela, who you met a while ago, and I just said, hey, if I'm ever going to do this book, it's got to be now. I'm fired up. The fire's burning. However, we've got two farms. You know, we've got 128 acres here and got another farm south of here. And I said, there's going to be some stuff I can't do. I know me, my attention deficit is of such. There's just going to be things you're going to have to take care of. And she said, do it. I'll see to it. So I couldn't have done it without my wife.
What a woman.
And it took me about right at 13 months, 12 months and 3 weeks from the first word until the day it went to the printers. And I'm 7 days a week. You know, I can remember, and you can too, when we were kids, there were times we looked forward to going to bed because of what we were going to do in the morning. And for the first time since I was a child, I got to the point that I looked forward to going to bed at night. Because I knew when I got up in the morning at 4:30 or 5, I was going to be fresh and that I was going to have 2 or 3 hours that it would flow and it would work. And that's what I would do. You know, I'd work 3 hours and take a couple hours off. Angela and I'd have coffee and then I'd come back at it. I took Thanksgiving that year. I took off 3 days because the kids were home. And it took me over 2 weeks after they were gone. After I started sitting back at the computer, it took me over 2 weeks to get the fire burning again.
Get in that groove.
Yeah. Oh, I'd sit at the computer, but I wouldn't get over a sentence or two. And I might delete that the next day. Mm-hmm. But it, you know, so going back to your question, no, I don't see me doing the book. Now, my wife, Angela, is going to do a book on Lee Clay Products out of Clearfield, Kentucky. Hmm. It was a sewer tile plant. They moved in, and first they had timber, cut all the timber. And that's about the time in the 1920s when the Industrial Revolution started, and they started, people started plumbing, and they were making sewer tile pipe. So, but at the end of the day, you had all of these guys that was doing this folk art. So I'm going to help her. I'm going to help her do that.
Right.
But no more books.
Understand.
Too much.
Yeah. Understand.
Kind of like giving birth. It hurt like hell. I like the end product, but it hurt like hell.
I haven't written anything as extensive as what you put together, but I've written 6 books. So it's
really,
yeah, it's, and I just turned in the manuscript for my latest one.
Oh, wow.
So,
oh, good for you.
Yeah. So it's, I understand. It is like giving birth.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And it seems like I have a very similar process to you. I wake up in the mornings and I'll crank it out.
Yeah.
I mean, I get up at 4 a.m. to write because I am on point.
That's the same with me.
Yeah.
I just found though that if I didn't stay on it during the day, like if I really went and got my mind off on something else, boy, I had to be careful. Mm-hmm. I mean, I just had to be really, really careful in order to stay focused. And then there was, of course, stuff in my book I didn't know anything about, you know. So I just started seeing as the book come together, and I started, getting an idea of what it needed to be in order for it to be viable. And you know, I needed it to pay for itself.
Yeah,
you know, sure. I didn't want to make a bunch of money, but I didn't want to spend $80,000 or $100,000, you know, publishing a book. And then me not recoup it. So, mm-hmm. you know, just like pottery. I didn't really know anything about Kentucky pottery, but I knew a girl that had done her doctoral dissertation on Southern pottery. So Brenda Heindel is her name. She's actually, you know, I do a show at Lake Cumberland every year. Mm-hmm. This is the 30th year the Lake Cumberland store show. And Brenda's going to be my guest speaker. I always have a guest speaker on Saturday afternoon. So she's going to come and talk about Southern pottery. And but anyway.
I know we could talk all day.
Well, sure,
but I think we've covered Simon very well. Is that
right.
You feel good about
I
that?
I do. Awesome. I don't know what else I could tell you.
Okay. Well, thank you for your time.
You're very welcome.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
Are
we going to have time to talk about GRC or no?
Sure, absolutely.
Okay. Let's shut this one down.
Okay.
And that wraps up another fantastic episode of the Nature Blinds podcast. I hope today's journey has inspired you to explore and connect with the natural world in new and exciting ways. Before I say goodbye, remember to check out the Nature Blinds School online membership. If today's episode sparked your interest in wilderness skills and outdoor adventures, this online community is the perfect place for you to start or continue your journey. You can currently sign up for a year for only $99 and get 2 months for free. Click the link below to discover a world of expert-led courses, engaging content, and a vibrant community eager to share their knowledge and experiences. Whether you're starting your outdoor journey or looking to deepen your existing skills, the Nature Reliant School online membership is here to guide you. Thank you for joining us today. Don't forget to subscribe for more adventures and share this podcast with your fellow nature enthusiasts. Until next time, come on, join in. Let's learn together.